welcome to East Meets West. I'm Olga Bataman.
I'm Tara Reid.
And I really want to start this episode with what happened to our old and good friend Daniel Kovalik just the other day. Mm-hmm. Daniel, as you may know, is an American human rights defender, I would say, and a lawyer and a writer. So he was flying to Great Britain, to Liverpool, and at the Liverpool airport, he was not just detained and questioned, but also all of his devices were taken away from him, and he never got them back. And you know, as a lawyer, he has personal information about his clients in his notebook, for example, in his phone. So he never got his devices back, and he had to buy a new phone. And it was all done under the Terrorist Act, which is, you know, this universal
in the United Kingdom,
which is this universal pretext, I think, you know, to detain anyone who speaks in favor of Russia, in who protects, you know, the rights of Palestinians, who is standing against the war in Iran. So that was Daniel, what he was doing. And I see it as a blatant intimidation from the side of United Kingdom. And, you know, I'm having this book with me today, which is Zbigniew Brzezinski's, the grand chessboard. And it's interesting that while he was looking into major actors on the international arena, Russia, China, Iran, even European countries, France, Germany, that may have some sort of independent, you know, interests in this game, United Kingdom was not even mentioned as not being an independent player on the international arena at all. And that's what we see happening now, I think.
Yeah, and from an international law point of view, I mean, I think it's overreach. He's an American citizen. He has no ties to UK. So how did the UK hold, you know, take his devices or, you know, when he's obviously not engaged in any terrorist activities? I mean, Dan Kovalik is a human rights attorney, well known, and he basically gives speeches. He was a law professor.
He also
spoke at the UN Security Council. And in fact, what happened was I was supposed to speak, but UK delegation and the US delegation stopped me an hour before I was to speak. So I gave my notes and he had his own research as well, and he combined it and he went in my place and spoke, and he did such an eloquent job at the UN Security Council. And then here you have the UK again.
And first of all, he was fired from Pittsburgh University,
he
where he was working.
Yes.
And now we have we see this blatant intimidation.
Yeah.
So Daniel, I don't have a spare room in my apartment, but I have a couch in the living room. So I guess you'll definitely feel safer here. And my coach is your coach, Daniel. You know, we stand for you. We stand with you, and we love you.
Yeah, he's done so many, and he's done great, you know, look for him online. Speaking of online, I wanted to thank all of you who've been sending messages and following us. It really helps us if you subscribe to our YouTube channel, subscribe to us on our social media. So as you follow us, don't just watch, subscribe, hit that subscribe button. That really is awesome. And, you know, independent voices are needed in the space. And we are in both Russian and English. So we have a wide audience that we want to reach.
Trying to make it even wider.
Speaking of even wider, we are speaking to someone whom I met in Valdai and whom I admire very much. And I'll let you...
Nelson Wong is joining us from China, from Shanghai. And I already mentioned this book that I brought with me to the studio today. And there is a whole chapter dedicated to China. So let's just go through the news and then discuss whether Zbigniew Brzezinski, while writing his book as a textbook, he said it openly that he was writing this book as a textbook. And I really think that U.S. decision makers were using as a textbook in their international politics. So whether he was right or wrong, whether there was some miscalculation. So Nelson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I've watched a few episodes of your show, which is great. I think you guys are doing a wonderful job. So I'm glad to be on your program. And thank you again for having me.
Thank you for such a compliment.
Yes, and we really appreciate it. And, you know, I was always so impressed with you. You were one of the first people I met when I went to the Valdai Discussion Club. And you also saw me speak to President Putin, and I was so nervous. I was trying to speak Russian. He was very patient with my very choo-choo to Russian. But you always had such interesting things to say in our discussion panels. That's why we really wanted you here today to talk about. There's so many big geopolitical things that have happened since last year.
So maybe let's start with the newsy events, so to say. And I mean, attention, I think, worldwide is attracted to what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz. The time of this temporary deal is kind of running out. We still do not see any deal or something. But what I would love to ask you is, you know, we've talked to a number of experts, and some were saying that this U.S. attack on Iran not only had a goal of a regime change in Iran, but also had a goal of countering the rapid economic development of China, since about 40% of all of China's oil intake was going through the Strait of Hormuz. So, what do you think? What would you say? Did this war in Iran reach this goal of the United States? Or some experts say that, on the contrary, China somehow managed to turn this situation in its favor and to become one of the winners. What would you say? Unwillingly, of course.
Well, first of all, I believe I must say the war on Iran is a tragedy. And just look at, for every war, I mean, the killing of innocent and civilian people. And that's really a disaster. Let's talk about China's position. Because when the war broke out, yes, there were a lot of speculations of how long it's going to take, whether it's going to be a week or it's going to be longer than a month or even longer. I remember being called upon by the CCTV, China's central television station, to do a program. And I said that if the war is going to last for more than 30 days, then we have a problem. If it's going to be less than 30 days, then things will become manageable, because I don't think this comes as a real shock to people, because it is a war that is being expected to some extent. So most of the countries actually had reserve, but the reserves are reserves and they will run out sooner or later. So if the war is going to last over 1 month, then I think it's going to create a big problem worldwide. Not only the oil price is going to be pushed up to 80 to even over $100 a barrel, but the entire supply chain worldwide is going to be disrupted. And that's going to be a real problem. Now, looking back, I think the U.S. has started, or the Trump administration has started, the war without full preparation and without knowing how to end it. That's the problem with most, you know, devastating wars, because when something happened, they never planned it like this. Mm-hmm. And when it becomes something that becomes uncontrollable, then it's going to turn into a bigger disaster. And of course, They mistook it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they believed that it could be over a week. The war can be over a week. They took out the supreme leader, and then the country is going to collapse. No, Iran is not Iraq. Of course, in every country, I would say, not everyone loves their government. There are always people that are, you know, that disagrees with their government. That's quite natural. Whether it's in democracy or what they call authoritarian countries, there are always people who do not really agree with what the government says. But it doesn't mean that you can go as an outsider, you can go into a country to mess with their domestic affairs, to throw out their government. No, for countries like this, it unites the people. It unites the people. So this has become a war that I think the U.S. government or the current White House administration is finding it difficult how to end it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't have plan A, let alone plan B, right?
And so I think it applies to many other crises we have now. I mean, even in the war in Ukraine, Europe has got no plan B. And that's also a problem. You know, they just want to keep bleeding Russia out. They want to destroy Russia without realizing that Russia cannot be defeated. It's the same thing. So people are in a dilemma. And this, I think, when you mention Olga, the Brzezinski's book, his famous book, I think they came from a different generation. I can relate to that because I'm a little older than you girls, and I was born in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. So I grew up during the Cold War, and in China we had the Cultural Revolution as well. And I left mainland China and moved to Hong Kong when I was in my early 20s. So I myself actually also got brainwashed somewhat during the development of my career. I was in real estate, I was in consulting, investment banking. So I also believed when I was younger, in my younger days, that the globalization was good and, you know, things will have to operate like this. But then, at the turn of the century, we started talking about the changing of the world, that the 21st century is going to be the century for the Pacific. We started talking about that. And the word multipolar was actually mentioned at the turn of the century and discussed widely, actually. So when referring back to Brzezinski's the book, The Great Chessboard, talking about big powers, well, the nightmare for the U.S. was that Iran, China, Russia would come together.
Mm. And now we see his nightmare coming true, actually, right? Yes.
Exactly. And now his nightmare is coming true. Answering to your question about China's response towards the war in Iran, first of all, I think there are people discussing about the possible damage to China because China imports a lot of oil and gas from that region, not only from Iran, but also from the region. A lot of the imports actually goes through the Strait of Hormuz. But I said it's not only that. China has vested interest in that region because that region alone has become a big market for Chinese export of goods, daily necessities, light industrial products, EVs, electric vehicles, and infrastructure investments. So China is widely exposed financially. Actually, it's not about oil import. Sorry.
Brenda. No, I was going to ask you because we had spoken on the sidelines of Valdai. It was right when Trump was coming into power. And I remember Trump had run on no endless wars. But he's always been a bit aggressive. But the first thing he did in office was get aggressive economically towards China. Did his demeanor and his relationship with China surprise you? Or did you feel like he's going in the direction that you predicted he would go? I mean, what was your feeling on all that?
And if I may add, we all know that the United States is highly dependent on China in terms of rare earth materials, highly dependent. And still, the United States, you know, it imposes tariffs, over 100%. It arms Taiwan. So how can you be, dependent on the country and you know, sending all of your big business heads, you know, on a trip to China, trying to make deals, and hitting it with the other hand, you know, with the tariffs, with the trade wars, with arming of Taiwan. How can it all combine in the heads of the U.S. decision makers?
Yeah. And U.S. owes China money too, on top of it.
But I think you guys have touched upon a very interesting topic, because I think it has a lot to do with perception. Because perception is reality in politics, in geopolitics. Perception is reality. And I think most people, Tara, you're from America, you know the country so well. I think it's very difficult for people, not only in America, but also in Europe, to accept the changing of the world. It is very hard to swallow the pride. It is difficult, because for the 100 and 200 or even more 100 years, they have been dominating the world. So they believe that they not only own the world, they write the book, the rules of how the world is going to be governed. And this is something that is embedded already in not only the DNA, but in the thinking, in the perception of how to look at the world. So it's us and against us. Those who are, you are either with me or against me. So, and the US as a country, its power has been developed based on the notion of having allies. So, but the allies are not there to be protected. The allies are to be used to show power, to show power. So it is me and me. So it is always me, me, me. So when he said, when Trump came into power, he said, I don't like wars. I'm going to end this war. I'm going to end this war, that war. I'm going to end everything. Yeah, I'm a peace-loving. I'm a businessman. I want to make money. Yeah, but he doesn't know that the rest of the world understand that the U.S. president is not a dictator himself, because his hands and feet are tied up as well by the people who put him in power. So that's a reality. No matter how much he wants to stop the war, there is that much far he could go. And the war in Ukraine has proven, right? He can't stop it. He couldn't stop it. So for China, yes, tariff. He thought that, I mean, he started raising tariff for every country. Most of the countries either went quiet or on their knees. But when it comes to China, China's response was so quick and swift, immediately retaliate. And I remember giving a talk at the High School of Economics last year. I said, China prepared for more than 10 years for this particular day. China knew what was coming. So it was fully prepared. Now, I said, if you look at the figures, before Trump announced the tariff war against China, China's export dependency on the U.S. was close to like 18%.
Oh, wow.
18% of China's export were towards the U.S. Yeah. But that was already a drop from a much higher ratio.
Right.
So within half a year, it dropped down to below 8%.
Wow.
That was a big blow to see who is messing with who.
Right.
Because China spent the last 10 years preparing for this and then diversifying its markets. So that's why the global Africa, and then Latin America, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, the markets, you know, got opened. And that's what the Belt and Road Initiative was also part of what it was about. It's about diversifying the export market, because the last 30, 40 years of China's fast economic development was mainly export driven. And the US was, you know, has proven to be such an important market, and the joining of WTO opened up the market for China. Yes, of course. So China, for many years, China said that we are the beneficiary of the globalization. So we are not against this order, but you do not bully people like as if you can do whatever you like. And then on the other hand, everyone knows Taiwan is China's core interest. You cannot do this ambiguity, practice this ambiguity forever. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you say one China. On the other hand, you start selling arms. You keep selling arms to Taiwan. You promised before that you're going to start reducing. You are going to reduce. But no, you're increasing. Keep increasing. So I said, China has learned it the hard way. And not only China has prepared for the tariff war, the trade war, but China do not have unrealistic expectations of the U.S. anymore. So it's not about that. If you watch closely, China's foreign ministry spokesperson, there is always a term that Chinese government use. We do not listen only to what people say. We watch what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So saying is one thing. You can say 100 beautiful things, but you did something very nasty. That's, you know, we know this is coming. So that's why diversification is a policy that China has adopted for more than a decade. And so this also comes to the topic of Iran. Yes, China has a 25-year long contract to buy oil from Iran. But it doesn't mean if the worst case happens, that things get worse and oil import from Iran gets stopped, what can China do? So China has diversified already. So that's why it's a country that is already prepared for the worst case scenario. But there is a misconception, mostly by the West, is that because the history of Europe and North America is about power, is about me taking over your power and become the powerful one, one after another. But China comes from a different culture. We have a totally different philosophy. We don't buy this kind of thing, that either you are my friend or you are my enemy. Mm-hmm. And that's why I remember during one of the Valdai discussions, I quoted a Confucius saying. I said, a real gentleman is someone that seeks to get along with people, even if he does not necessarily agree with them. So we don't have to agree with you on everything, but it doesn't stop us from doing business. So this is the Chinese philosophy, that we have different political systems, we have different values, but it doesn't mean we can't do business together. It's about trade. And China is a nation of traders, And then we do not do business and to use this as a leverage to mess with other countries' domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. So I remember many years ago during one of the discussions, an ex-politician, a former politician from Indonesia said, and that impressed me a lot. He said, well, many countries came to Indonesia and do business, and they all have conditions. But China is different. China came to us and tried to negotiate a deal, and then it didn't work out. We said, okay, then our friendship will remain, but let's see if we can come back later, maybe next year, maybe the year after. But we don't impose anything on you. These are our terms. If it can be agreed, then let's do it. If not, you want to negotiate, I have my bottom lines, you have your bottom lines. Okay, if we cannot meet in the middle ground, then okay, let's part, and then we're not enemies. Let's find a moment. Maybe things will get changed next year. So this is the way Chinese conduct business. So I said, it reflects, it's in our DNA. So when China got accused by people saying that the Belt and Road Initiative, China is starting a new wave of colonialism, I said, come on, it's not in our DNA. Even if you tell China you can colonize this country, I said, we don't know how to do it. We don't know, because it's not in our DNA. We don't know that. So I said, doing business with China, trying to get along with Chinese, you have to understand the culture. And so I said, people are different. Chinese can never make Americans like Chinese. And Russians can never make Arabs like Russians. And that's why we're different. So it's the diversity that makes our world so colorful and interesting. So it's all about coexistence. So how can we find a way to coexist? It is not easy. I totally admit that it is not easy, because the modern history of mankind, or even from ancient times, it has proven to be the opposite. So nowadays, with more and more powers coming onto the world stage, and think about nuclear. Now it's not the Soviet Union and against the US, two superpowers. How many countries has nuclear weapons nowadays? More than 10 already. So the world is getting more and more dangerous, and I think we are living in a very volatile time. Anything could happen, and that's why we have to remain absolutely diligent while still keeping hope and a good intention. That's my take.
Nelson, since you mentioned this coalition between Russia and China that Zbigniew Brzezinski was warning about, let me just quote. So first of all, he didn't believe that China would be able to sustain the temp of its economic growth for even 20 years. Secondly, right, that he thought it was unlikely that China would consider any long-term and comprehensive Russia-Chinese alliance. That's, I am quoting him here. And the third thing is, he said that the attitude of Chinese to Russia, I quote, that Russia was held in cultural contempt, which is a hard wording, I have to say, and even that the very word Russia in Chinese meant hungry land. He used it as an argument. First of all, is it true that in Chinese, Russia stands for the hungry land? And why do you think he miscalculated it that much? Because everything I said here went completely wrong, completely different from
and
what
I
Russia.
Mean, you see the respect and admiration that President Xi and President Putin have for one another. I don't think that's political theater. It's an actual honest respect for each other and kind of an embracing of each other's cultures, but again, without intruding. It's very non-intrusive, but it definitely a good partnership.
And definitely it's far from disdain,
far from
that he's, he's saying that that's how China was looking at Russia. So why do you think he miscalculated it all that much?
Well, I think it's a typical Cold War mindset. And it's the perception that people of that generation actually held. That, you know, China is a communist country, it's evil, and then Russia was a communist country, and these countries are authoritarians, and we are liberal democracy. There is always this element of ideology there, without realizing that the world has changed and humanity has advanced. Mm-hmm. The problem we have, I remember talking to some scholars in Europe, we agreed that a lot of the problems today in the world started because the technological advancements are much faster than the development of humanities, actually, of humanities, of social sciences. We're lagging behind in terms of social science. So
emotional intelligence. Yeah. You're talking about emotional intelligence. Yeah, like our development psychologically, emotional intelligence wise, has way below our ability to handle what's coming, which, you know, AI, China is much more advanced in AI than, say, I think the US. Although,
but by the way, Brzezinski in his book said that even if, which was a big if for him, China managed to sustain the tempo of its development for 20 years, he said that Chinese people would still be poor and the access to computers, phones, and cars would still be low. I mean,
that's hilarious.
It's hilarious, just isn't it?
It's hilarious, and I have to share with you, Nelson. Just when I was looking into some of your appearances in the past, too, talking about technological developments in China and whatnot, there was an American creator who was talking about the Chinese technology and how it's superior and less expensive than American, and then Americans are trying to find ways to buy Chinese technology, phones, computers, laptops, everything. Yeah.
Now people are all understanding that the competition in the future between the two big powers, China and the US, are in technology. Technology is very, crucial in the, it will become the driving force. And yes, but China is, catching up. I would say China is catching up in AI. Some people say in certain areas, China is already ahead. I said, it's not about competing. It's not about competing. This, once again, what's the purpose of competition? I would prefer the word co-optition. Cooperation and competition. You still have to find a way to coexist. China never wanted to, use the last resort in retaliating the US by restricting the export of rare earth. Never wanted that.
Right.
But when you get pushed to the corner, what are you going to do? Basically, we're telling the Americans that, hey, don't forget, I have this that you need. If I stop, then what? If I stop exporting, then what? So immediately, it came down. Yeah. So now it's extension of another 18 months, of another 18 months, of another 18 months. And I said, it basically means that it's over. The tariff war is over.
Right.
Right? So, Olga, you touched on a very sensitive topic, China and Russia. Who would have thought, let's say 10 years ago, who would have thought that China and Russia would enjoy the relationship we have now? I don't think anybody has ever thought about it, not to mention Brzezinski. Right. If you ask an average Russian citizen or an average Chinese, nobody would believe so. Nobody would believe so. So I think that is a typical evolving of human history. China has a difficult history with Russia. And that's a fact. And let us do not ignore that or neglect that. It existed. Mm-hmm. Our two countries had a difficult past, but we have to move on. we're not children. We have to act like adults. So for big countries like China and Russia sharing such a long border, I even talked about this in China. I said, how many people really understand? There are over 100 agreements signed between our two countries to solve all our border disputes. So we don't have any disputes about the border anymore. What is done is done.
But the more precious alliance we have, right? The more precious is this friendship between our leaders, isn't it?
Yes. So the consensus, the sharing of perception towards the world and the mutual trust between our two leaders is very important. It's very important. But I remember talking at several functions in Russia, in Moscow, I said, the leaders' consensus and the trust, is it important? Absolutely important, but that's not enough. I said, if you look at the trade between China and Russia, yes, it's increasing every year, but most of that is still oil and gas trade by big state-owned companies from China. Is that important? Yes, but that's not enough. A real solid relationship between the two countries will have to go far beyond that. Mm-hmm. It needs to engage the private enterprises of both countries to come together, to do business together, for Chinese companies to set up facilities in Russia, for Russian companies to come to China, because it's the people's interreaction that will make us understand each other and to appreciate each other. Because doing business, I said, it's the same like if finding for a guy to find a girlfriend, right? If you want the other party to trust you, if you want to win over the heart of a young lady, you have to give your heart to her first. So it's heart for heart. Mm-hmm. So, and then also to appreciate everything of the other party. So I said, Russian literature, it's not only about Lev Tolstoy. It's not only about, War and Peace, Anna Karenina, Crime and Punishment. There are a lot more. There are a lot more. So rich tradition in Russian literature. What about paintings? What about arts? What about ballet? What about music? So these are the things that China... More and more Chinese people, and the younger generation in particular, needs to understand and to appreciate. And this will increase the trust, the good feeling towards another people, and the vice versa. The same thing should happen. So it's the interaction between the peoples that will solidify the relationship long term.
I think it's already happening because we have a visa-free regime, you know, so people can travel, businessmen can travel. It's already happening. The companies are cooperating, for example, in construction of the Northern Route. You know, there's so many projects and the visa-free regime definitely facilitates it. But Nelson, if I may ask you, since you mentioned communism and just the other day, Trump warned that he called communism the biggest threat after the Second World War, you know, and after 9/11. Pearl Harbor on 9/11. Of course, he was addressing those left Democrats. He was addressing them. He was addressing them. But, you know, we have a Communist Party in Russia, which I doubt threatens anyone. You have a Communist Party. So what do you think of this saying of President Trump? Calling communism the biggest threat.
Well, I believe somebody has tipped him to say so.
Yeah.
maybe somebody has tipped him to say so to try and win over the Democrats, maybe the neocons. I think this is really an out of date, out of fashion discussion.
Right. It feels like we're back to the Cold War. Like, what's going on?
And I think you're dealing with, you know, with a new generation coming in. It's not even playing to them. They're not registering it in America. I don't know if they are in Europe,
exactly.
but I know that Gen Z, when they hear things like that, the way it falls flat. So that kind of rhetoric that you have these people in that party and the neocons that are stuck.
Yeah.
And they're giving out this propaganda that no one's really listening to. It's just sort of like going. And plus, I think, you know, there's an issue of dementia with Trump right now. I do. I just think there is.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you a more existential question. And it's and, you know, coming from America, which has engaged in, we're now with our 250th anniversary coming up here on the weekend, July 4th. We have been at war pretty much the entire time with someone, even ourselves included. It's a very warlike nation. I know I come from a very hawkish nation. Yet we became a superpower and people, so then people will argue, well, this is how you maintain that. But then you look at China. China is a superpower. And when was the last time they've engaged in conflict like that to those levels? So I wanted to ask you this existential question. When it comes to becoming a superpower in the world, what is the defining difference? Because you see two huge powers, one taking the path of war, one that has done more innovation and peace. What is your thought on that?
Well, I think I quite agree with the Chinese government's position by saying, keep telling the US that we do not want to replace you. We do not want to be another US. Even if our GDP or whatever surpass the US, we don't want to be like you. Because don't get it wrong, not everyone wants to be an American. and this is something, because this is the notion that everyone wants to be like us. No, this is not the case. Chinese will forever be Chinese. Russia will forever be Russians. The Arabs will forever be Arabs. So people, this is the wrong perception. And that's why I said a lot of the problems came from that perception.
American
that everyone wants to American. Yeah. American exception, yes.
Yeah.
So for China, I think China is now becoming quite vocal, becoming quite vocal, which is good and necessary, that China wants to be a different power. It will be a different power. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be the US superpower that you used to know. It's different because we're not messing up with other countries' business. We don't want war. We don't want to bully people. And we just want to do business. We treat everybody equally politically. Politically, every country, big or small, should be on equal standing. Economically, of course, countries are different. So that's how we'll try to find a way of coexistence. It is not easy. It is not easy, particularly when you have, you know, the U.S. and other Western countries still sending their ships to Taiwan Strait. For what? Freedom of navigation? To show this is ridiculous for Canada to send a ship before and Germany 2 years ago to send a ship. Why? And for UK to send a ship as well. God, how many ships do you have? Only one, that aircraft carrier. Don't do it. What if it goes wrong? You can't sail back. So this is something that, you know, to the average Chinese, I think all you have to do is just to give it a laugh. Why? Sometimes I think we have to learn to ignore. We have to learn to ignore and move on. and move on, because the new world is waiting ahead of us. Let's move on. Yeah. Several weeks ago in St. Petersburg during the Economic Forum, I said, let us do not spend too much time or waste too much time talking about the old order. It's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. Why spending and wasting time talking about that any longer? If you really get bored, then you start talking about that. Otherwise, I said, life is short, time is precious, let's move on. Let's move on. And then ignore those that is not worth spending time.
Right.
That's my take.
I guess that's the best thought we can end our conversation on.
Yeah.
And I mean, since we were discussing this book, even Zbigniew Brzezinski, the last chapter was dedicated to the multipolar world. So even he realized that this...
Yeah.
United States being a single global power, this time would come to an end, that it's not eternal, and then the multipolar world would come true. Okay, here there was no miscalculation, as we see.
Yeah, it was
well,
very...
Well, let's, assume humility, more humility, less arrogance.
Right.
And, less arrogance, more humility, and then also that way... We don't have to fear anything, because fear, a lot of the problems are created by fear.
Mm-hmm.
The fear of losing power, the fear of losing control, the fear of losing money. So, and fear can make people irrational. So have more confidence in ourselves. I think read more history books, and then, interact with people from different cultures. I keep reciting sometimes whenever I have a chance of a famous quote from an anthropologist, Franz Bauers. He said, the history of mankind proves that advances of culture depend upon the opportunities presented to a group from the others. The more varied the contacts, the greater the opportunities to learn. The tribes of the simplest culture are on the whole those that have been isolated for very long periods and hence could not profit from the achievements of their neighbors. So let's learn from each other.
Brilliant.
Yes, that's a wonderful way to end our show. Thank you so much
Thank
for being
so
with
much
us.
Thank you so much for being with us, Nelson.
Yeah.
Thank
it
you.
Was really nice to see you again.
Thank
I hope
you for
to see
having
you again
me.
Soon.
It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, and to our viewers, please stay in touch with us. Send us your guest suggestions, your questions maybe. We'll try our best to ask them for you.
And we'll see you next time. Peace out.
Take care.
Take care.